Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Tom Butler.
And I'm Brendan Duffy.
You're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast.
Join us on this journey of discovery across the world of the 007 movies as we take an encyclopedic look at cinema's greatest spy films.
We'll learn about the people who made them in front of the camera and behind, from Ken Adam to Mac Zorin, with the occasional detour down a few rabbit holes. And we'll sometimes be joined by guests with unique insight into the world of Bond.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the James Bond brand, Eon, or the Fleming Estate. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we do get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us on podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the James Bond A to Z podcast, where T is for The World Is Not Enough, the 1999 Bond film starring Pierce Brosnan as 007. My name is Tom Butler, and joining me as we take a look at the story behind the 19th James Bond film, he's always got an escape plan, is Mr. Brendan Duffy.
Hello, we should escape this episode.
Oh, and joining us once again, he doesn't know any doctor jokes, it's George Aldridge from the Cinema 7 YouTube channel.
Hello there.
George, welcome back to the show. When we were looking for guests to come on in this stage of the podcast, you were very keen to do The World Is Not Enough. Can you explain why that is and your sort of your history with the film?
Yeah, of course. It was the very first James Bond film I saw. And this is responsible for me becoming a fan, falling in love with Pierce Brosnan. The rest, I guess, is history as the years went by. So it holds a very special place in my heart. And it's got some great memories back to when I was younger, whether it's the PlayStation game playing with my dad on a Saturday morning, or you know, just watching the film. And it's one that's been interesting seeing the James Bond community speak about over the last couple of years as well.
And you were talking before you came on, but you saw it quite a young age.
Yeah, so I did some research aside from for the episode tonight on my history with it. So the backstory is that I always remember watching it on TV. The younger generation might not know, but before Sky Plus and all that sort of stuff, you had to record with a VHS tape. And I remember being shown this film, The World Is Not Enough, and it was on a VHS, and it began during the pre-title sequence after Bilbao. So I never knew about that. I thought that was something for the PlayStation game only that they'd done. And it always just began with the explosion at MI6 and a boat chase. So that was my early memories with it, and I found out that it's UK broadcast, because of course I didn't see it at the cinema. I would have been three when it was out then. It premiered on UK TV on the 14th of November 2001, which means I would have been 5 years old when it was recorded for us to watch when that was, and I'm still taken aback, you know. Then 1 year later I went to watch Dine of the Day at the cinema, and yeah, I think what the perfect age, I think, to get into James Bond, if I'm being honest, is that early 2000s, I think, for the Brosnan era.
Absolutely. I mean, Brendan, this must be sort of your golden era for Bond.
Yeah, I was already in love with Pierce Brosnan at this point. And I do remember being really impressed with the opening sequence, the boat chase, and then landing on the dome. I just thought that was so relevant. I would have been about 12, 13. So, yeah, very impressionable at that age.
Yeah, and for me, I think this is the one I can remember of the ones I watched from the start, following the making of it before it actually came out. This is the one I can vividly remember, like reading interviews with Sophie Marceau, seeing the newspapers with the stuff on the Thames, just being like, following it and getting so excited for it. So yeah, it's an exciting one to talk about. There is a lot to talk about on this one, but let's kick off with a synopsis. So when Agent 007 is assigned to protect a beautiful oil heiress, he's catapulted into a passionate, adrenaline-charged adventure that pits him against one of his most deadly adversaries, Reynard, a ruthless anarchist whose total imperviousness to pain makes him a virtually unstoppable enemy. The unrelenting suspense, breathtaking action, and sly wit never let up in this explosively entertaining thriller. Fairly accurate, but also slightly misleading there. I guess that's the MGM spoiler machine still working there. But 1999 is not enough, but it is a perfect place to start, Brendan.
Isn't it just one of the biggest things that people were talking about at this point? Any guesses? What was worrying people in 1999?
Oh, was it the Millennium Bug?
Yes, the Y2K Millennium Bug, which was referring to the potential errors in computers at the time with their formatting. People thought planes were going to drop out of the sky as well. You know, it really was sort of, there was a lot of speculation of stuff that didn't end up happening really. Which is referenced in the film, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a mention of it, isn't there?
Yeah. So obviously in 1999, we did have those Millennium celebrations started at the end of the year, and they opened the Dome in London, which is now the O2, and the London Eye, which is on the Thames. But in terms of film, there's a lot of good stuff coming out in 1999. Kubrick's last film, Eyes Wide Shut, which of course he died 5 days after he finished filming it. The Matrix came out. Ooh. A revolutionary film. Yeah. The Iron Giant, which is fantastic. South Park. I mean, I can't believe it's that long ago.
Still going.
The Best Picture winner at the Oscars was American Beauty, directed by...
Sam Mendes,
yes. Other films that were released, The Green Mile, Tarzan, Fight Club, and Magnolia.
Oh, it was a golden era, wasn't it?
It really was, yeah. And we also had Columbia and MGM celebrating their 75th anniversaries in 1999. But the top three at the box office, any guesses?
Phantom Menace.
Correct, that's number one. Yep, $924 million.
No, Matrix wasn't that big, was it?
No.
No. I have to give in. Don't know.
So, number three, Toy Story 2. Oh, $511 million. And then number two, The Sixth Sense. With $672 million. So many, you know, iconic films in that list, isn't there? It really was really a big year. And, you know, Bond's got a lot to do to sort of break into that.
Yeah, it really does.
I mean, The Phantom Menace is the first ever film I saw at the cinema, and I was three, so that's, I might not remember it being that year, but I did go multiple times, which is, it's very, I think the older we get, the scarier the anniversary seem to come for those kind of films, and I think it's starting to happen now with James Bond for me.
I imagine at age three, you probably found the comedy a bit beneath you.
I'm not going to lie, not to go off tangent, but as a child, I didn't like Jar Jar Binks. So I understood why people disliked him, but as I've grown older, I've come to appreciate him, which I think is like the anti, you know, that's not what the audience should be. But I did want to be Anakin Skywalker, like everyone my age at that point in time, before, you know, it all went wrong in for him in 2 and 3.
In terms of The World Is Not Enough, a lot of people talk about this one as being sort of, should we say, a spiritual sequel to the Honor Majesty's Secret Service. There's a lot of homages in play, I think, in this one. There's a lot of direct sort of, you know, you've got snow scenes, you've got Bond falling in love. It's when you listen to the audio commentary, they do reference it a lot. But in terms of the story and the script, George, what did you find out?
Yeah, so some may be familiar with the background to this, but it's fascinating when you read up on more detail. In November the 13th, 1997... an episode of ABC News Nightline premiered, which was 1 month before Tomorrow Never Dies was released in cinemas. And this news report detailed how the major oil companies were essentially all going to try and get control of the oil reserves in the Caspian Sea, of course, following on from the Soviet Union's collapse. And with Tomorrow Never Dies on its press tour, on its marketing tour, Barbara Broccoli was watching it on a flight after it had been recorded in December. And after she watched it, she suggested that it would make an appropriate motivation for a Bond villain. Which he then took forward to Michael G. Wilson, and they agreed with that respect. And then came the process of bringing in some writers and making their debut in the Bond series, of course, was for Purvis and Wade, who were both brought on board. The background to those two jumping on board was that Michael G. Wilson and Barbara Rocky liked their work on Let Him Have It and Plunkett and McLean. And after a meeting they had with them, they were also then shown the episode of Nightline that had inspired Barbara Broccoli to have this villain motivation. And they essentially agreed with that. They loved the idea of having a dead villain. And when I say a dead villain, they genuinely wanted a dead villain to be the Bond villain. Which
like Weekend at Bernie's.
Well, honestly, I'm not going to lie. Of everything I've researched, and there's some crazy stuff of this film, this is the one that's really thrown me off guard. The fact is that they didn't just get to write the film after that suggestion is that they wrote so many more. But they then compromised, and the idea came forward to have Renard having a bullet lodged in his brain. So that was the background to that. And a few more little tidbits. You mentioned Honor Manager's Secret Service. Purvis wanted a female villain for this, and Tracy was essentially his inspiration for Elektra. Very much the spoilt daughter of the very wealthy individual, falling in love with Bond, and then of course it diverting into her becoming the main villain for the film, which I absolutely love the fact that they went back to that, and it really just showed that their knowledge of the James Bond series. And the first draft of the film was actually completed before Michael Apted came on board to direct. Following Michael Apted coming on board, Dana Stevens, who I found out was his wife as well, came on board. She then wrote two drafts of the film across 3 weeks, which was very centrically focused on M and Elektra. And because it ended up with it being essentially an M versus Elektra film, they then brought Bruce Feirstein on board to rewrite all of the scenes involving James Bond himself. And I've got a lovely quote from Michael Apted from the Making of the World Is Enough book, who said, "We were very lucky. The boys did the start, Dana did the women, and Bruce did the Bond." And that's how the script came to be.
In terms of the director, we mentioned Michael Apted already. Before we get to Michael Apted, the producers looked at... They approached Martin Campbell to return. He had obviously done a really good job with GoldenEye. They wanted to see if he would come back and do it again. He declined. They also had serious discussions with Alfonso Cuarón to direct. The Mexican director, obviously we know him now for, like, you know, Gravity and what have you. But at the time, he had just moved into American filmmaking. He directed an episode of Fallen Angels and also a couple of feature films called A Little Princess and Great Expectations. So they got quite far down the line with him, but Robert Wade recalled that Alfonso Cuarón didn't... he felt he didn't quite understand the British idiom. And apparently Cuarón had suggested that they move the boat chase from the Thames to the Hudson River. So that was something they felt like it needs to be more British. And obviously, well, not so obviously, but coincidentally, Alfonso Cuarón does return to the series in Quantum of Solace as a cameo voice in that movie, doing the voice of a pilot. Other names that were linked include Joe Dante, and Peter Jackson was also came close to directing. But legend has it that Barbara Broccoli was given a screener of The Frighteners to watch and she didn't like it, so she changed her mind. So there we have it. So then in the end, they turned to Michael Apted and he was hired in August 1998, best known at the time for directing dramas like The Coal Miner's Daughter and Gorillas in the Mist, and also his documentary series 7-Up. In an interview with IndieWire, Apted said, "I just got a call from my agent saying, would I be interested in it? And I thought they were joking. They were seeing other directors. They didn't have this flash and say, Apted has to do Bond. So I went to see them about it and it became very clear why they wanted a drama director as opposed to an action director to beef up the characters in the story. Once I could figure out why they wanted me, I knew I wouldn't just be hanging on trying to catch up." So then he signed on, and it was obviously a 6-month shoot. He'd never done anything that big before in his life. And he did, as a drama director, he did set some time aside for rehearsing the movie, but he later admitted that that was a total waste of time. He said in an interview with Den of Geek, "It was completely ludicrous not to be remotely disrespectful to Pierce Brosnan, but it was like, now I'm jumping out of this, now I'm fighting with this guy. And I did take the trouble to go through a couple of scenes we had with M and maybe a couple of the girls and stuff like that, but it was a waste of time and slightly embarrassing. But Brosnan is a good man. So, yeah. So, I mean, I think he was hired to bring a sense of realism to the Bond films, as obviously being a documentary filmmaker. And as you say, he's also very good at the women's roles in films as well. I think a couple of his leading ladies had been nominated for Oscars. So that's why he brought in his wife, Dana Stevens, to work on the script. But yeah, I mean, later on, he said, talking about it, he said, the greatest social revolution of my lifetime has been the changing role of women in society. I've tried to avoid cliches. I've never allowed women to be ciphers or caricatures. I discovered it wasn't some great epiphany they'd had about offering me Bond. They just wanted to get more women in to see Bond films. So he thinks it was a bit of a shameless attempt at making the films appeal to women more, which is fair, I guess. So yeah, that was Michael Apted. And something interesting I learned about Michael Apted when I was watching the documentaries and listening to the audio commentary is that he shot the film slightly differently than other Bond directors had done before. He used multi-cameras. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but multi-cameras is often something they do on soaps and on TV, so they get more coverage out of scenes and they don't have to repeat scenes quite so often. So if one of the common complaints or criticisms of The World Is Not Enough is that it is a bit soap-like, well, that's because he shot it like a soap. So there you have it.
And then we've got the key crew. So cinematography is Adrian Biddle and editing is by Jim Clark. And Michael Apted actually said there were two key people who would help execute his vision. So he brought them on board. And the rest of them, it's pretty much, you know, picking some Bond veterans. David Arnold is back to do the music. We've got Peter Lamont. Now, he'd just worked on Titanic and got them the Oscar win. And so he was returning. And at this point, I found this astonishing because I just hadn't thought about it, but he had been production designing for Bond longer than Ken Adam at this point.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, we think as Ken Adam was doing such a really long stint, but Peter Lamont at this point has now done longer in the Bond franchise. And Michael G. Wilson said, the first thing we do when we start working on the script and we're thinking about locations and whether we can do this or that is we call up Peter Lamont. So by this point, he really had become a huge part of how they want Bond to look and you know, using all his expertise. Also, we get Vic Armstrong. He's back to direct second unit and help Michael Apted with action sequences. So with the boat chase, the ski sequence and the helicopter attack, he's all on hand to help with that. So yeah, it's a mixture. You've got a couple of new people brought on board by Apted, but on the whole, you've got the classics, people who know Bond.
All the classics, yeah.
Excellent. And alongside some returning key crew, we've also got some cast members. Of course, Piers Brosnan, in his third appearance as Bond. And we've got a fair few of the MI6 team to talk about. Judi Dench returns as M. Of course, this film, more than ever, probably focuses on M, I guess you could argue, until Skyfall comes along. Michael Kitchen returns as Tanner, as he wasn't in Tomorrow Never Dies. This was obviously following from Goldeneye. Colin Salmon also returns as Charles Robinson, following on from Tomorrow Never Dies. And Samantha Bond as Miss Moneypenny in her third appearance. And one of the major returns is, of course, Desmond Llewellyn in his what would be his final appearance as Q. Of course, I know there's been an episode on Q, so there'll be a lot more information with that, but this was his final film, and he passed away on December the 19th, just after the film came out, in a car accident whilst he was on the way to a book signing. Of course, the only actor to have worked with the first five James Bond actors. And I just had a quick look into some of the tributes that came after he passed away, obviously with it being between this and Dying of a Day. And Roger Moore led the tribute at his memorial service. They played All the Time in the World alongside this. And his son went on to say that Roger Moore was the Bond that worked with him the most. So it was Roger Moore that was chosen to come to the memorial. And a few of the Bond alumni that spoke was of the legendary Sir Christopher Lee. And Samantha Bond was also there. But another great name who returned was Robbie Coltrane as Valentin Sokovsky, who tragically lost quite a short while ago. This is, of course, his second appearance And Brosnan paid tribute to him earlier this year with a lovely line saying, I cannot think of a finer actor and man of humanity and humour to share the world stage with on such a day that as many so years ago. My sincere condolences, prayers, love and respect to the family. And just a little bit on Tarkovsky from me. What I found out is a lot of the lines he uses in this film were unused lines from GoldenEye. You know, we know those James Bond archives do go back many years, but it's one of the first times I've seen some incredible one-liners. Robbie Coltrane is one of those actors that, you know, for many generations, he'll always be Hagrid. But I think his time as Tarkovsky is so fiercely underrated because he has such a magnificent presence in his two films in the very short amount of screen time you get to spend with him.
Yeah, he's a great presence, isn't he? Because I think he's one of those where he's not a clear-cut villain, not a clear-cut ally, hero. He's just a great character that pops up. You know, he's like a Gogol type character who just has makes such an impression on screen. But obviously, Desmond Llewellyn, I mean, what end of an era, and the scenes that they shot for him, they couldn't have picked better scenes to shoot, really, could they?
It's incredible how they managed to, like, not knowing what would happen and how things would pan out, that end scene, you know, with so much more added context to it, and it makes it way more emotional.
Yeah, I think it really does.
As well, when I was younger, I'd never realised that he wasn't not meant to come back as Q. And I think that's obviously when you get older and you read about what happened, that was one of the biggest surprises to me. That it almost, in the sort of horriblest way, it worked in their favour if you were looking at it from that perspective. And it's, you know, of course, introducing R, who we'll speak about very shortly as well. It's a fascinating way for him to go. And I think, you know, I believe that there was inspiration from King Arthur and Merlin, the old stories of him sort of descending down as they said their farewell, which was also in some of the behind the scenes when they planned that final scene with him.
Interesting. Right, so onto the Bond girls and the new cast. So as I said, Michael Apted was brought in to beef up the female roles in this, and he really did sort of go to town here. It's got one of the best sort of lineup of female characters in any Bond film. He was interviewed by the Daily Telegraph before the film was being made, while he was promoting a documentary at the Sheffield Film Festival. And they obviously asked him about the Bond girls in his film. And he said, to which I replied that women were at the heart of the film and I wanted to make the women more interesting. We probably spoke for 3 minutes out of the 30-minute interview on that. The next day, he was flying to Istanbul to scout locations. And they showed him this page in the Daily Telegraph, which was filled with pictures of Bond girls and the headline, "No More Bikinis." And he said, and the quotes had been basically taken completely out of context. They said, "Forget bikinis. Women now have to be brainy and all that sort of stuff." And they called him a boring, grey-haired, liberal intellectual who's going to wreck Bond. He said it was all very jolly, but when the studio got extremely jumpy because about it and asked me what on earth I was doing, it was pretty tricky because I'd put my foot in it. So, I mean, you can see, you know, the tabloid rumours around Bond, like, have been going on forever. It's not it's not a new thing nowadays. It's been going on since the films began. But I will talk about the Bond girls in sort of a descending order. So the one with the least screen time is Cigar Girl, and that's Maria Grazia Cucinotta. And she's the one who sort of makes sure Bond escapes from the bankers at the start, and then she's then sent to take out Bond in the Thames chase sequence. She was known at the time for starring in the film Il Postino, and she had screen tested to play Elektra, but because her English wasn't up to scratch and she really wanted to be in the movie, they offered her the role of Cigar Girl. So that's Maria Grazia Cucinotta. Serena Scott Thomas plays Dr. Molly Warmflash. Now, Serena had made her film debut in the Purvis and Wade film Let Him Have It. And she is, of course, the younger sister of Kristen Scott Thomas. She'd also recently played Princess Diana in the adaptation of Andrew Morton's book, Diana, Her True Story. But Molly Warmflash, I mean, what a ridiculous name, isn't it? She was very complimentary about Pierce Brosnan. She called him a sweetie, says he's really fun. He doesn't have any of that ridiculous macho thing. He's normal, which maybe you shouldn't be, being James Bond. Then we have Denise Richards as Dr. Christmas Jones. United Artists had insisted that there be a second female lead and that they should be an American to appeal to audiences there, as they felt Elektra was just too far removed from what people expect from an archetypal Bond girl. She'd originally be written as a Polynesian girl who works as an insurance person for Lloyd's Bank. And the name they took from actually from their previous film, Let Him Have It, there was a character in that called Christmas Humphreys. So they took that name and used it again and made Christmas Jones. But in the early drafts, she was like a paperwork person, not an action girl. But when the treatment came back from UA, they said that they had to change it from an insurance investigator because Pierce Brosnan was going to star in the Thomas Crown Affair and the lead in that was an insurance investigator. So that's when the twist became that she was a nuclear expert. And so Denise Richards at the time was a huge star, really. She was really famous for Melrose Place, Loaded Weapons, Starship Troopers, Wild Things. And there was some backlash at the time of her being cast. I think a lot of people just saw her as a sort of a Hollywood bimbo, which is a bit unfair. And then talking about her casting at the time, she said, "I did my audition on Thanksgiving with Piers and Michael was there directing. I was quite young at the time, and once I got the role, I felt like Michael took me under his wing. Michael wanted Christmas Jones to put Bond in his place. She wasn't just the trophy Bond girl. That was her job. She took it seriously. He wanted her to be able to one-up Bond. Bond had met his match." So there's that. And then finally, you've got Sophie Marceau as Elektra. A lot of people were tested to play Elektra, including Vera Farmiga and also Sharon Stone. But Michael Apted had his heart set on Sophie Marceau after he'd seen her in a film called Firelight. And also she was in Braveheart as well. And she was screen tested using the torture scene in this film. So they used that one because it's a big meaty sort of acting role rather than being, you know, the woman in bed role from Russia with Love. Talking about it, she said, "You don't have to play the villain because the villain doesn't think she's a villain. She thinks she's defending a cause. A Bond film is a fantasy, something that is totally abstract in a way. I don't have to be conscious about being the villain because the film is conscious about it. It's a relief when the actor doesn't have to tell the story but just be the character." So that's the Bond girls.
Okay, so villains, we have... I'll start with the screen time. That's a good way of doing it. So we'll go with John Saru, who is an actor from Fiji and also a wrestler, and he plays Gabor. Gabor is the bodyguard to Electric King. Then we have Ulrich Thompson, and he is Sasha Davidov, and that's Electric King's head of security in Azerbaijan. But one of the most memorable has got to be the musician and DJ Goldie as Mr. Bullion. What a great name. Watching it now, it's weird to see him pop up in it, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is, yeah.
Can I confess something? I didn't know he was a musician till literally a year ago when my dad told me when we were watching it.
Oh, really?
I just assumed that he was a James Bond, like, just villain that had... He's got gold teeth as well, hasn't he? And he was a musician. Is it from Bristol?
Yeah, a very famous drum and bass DJ.
Yeah.
It completely blew my mind, honestly. I don't know if that makes me sound terrible or not, but that's incredible, as you find that as I've got older.
And then for the main villain, who is the international terrorist, he's the kidnapper of Elektra, Reynard. Now, Reynard was originally going to be played by Javier Bardem. We talked about that in what episode?
The R episode, I think.
Ah, that's it, yeah. But of course, he said his English wasn't up to scratch at this point. So that's the main reason he didn't take it. Also, Jean Reno, he turned the role down due to personal reasons at the time. So eventually they went for Robert Carlyle, who's a Scottish actor. And at the time, he was best known for his roles in Trainspotting and The Full Monty. Michael G. Wilson saw him portraying a character who was a psychopath in an episode of Cracker. And so thought he would be perfect for a villain role. And Robert Carlyle actually, he said that he told an actor friend that he was thinking of doing it. And then was introduced to a Bosnian actor called Velibor Topic, who basically told him all about different military stories and the horrors of war. And so he used that as his base to play the character. During the actual production, he was given an OBE. And the Queen said, "What are you doing at the moment?" And he just told her that he'd spent the whole day trying to kill James Bond. Yeah, that's Reynard, who is very good at holding hot rocks. What are your thoughts on Reynard?
I really like him. I think he's good.
Yeah, I'm the same. He's one of those characters where I think as a kid I was never scared by him, but I certainly enjoyed him more when I was younger in terms of an actual villain. I think as I've got older, I understand where a lot more people are coming from, and I think the more I've seen from Robert Carlyle, I feel that I don't want to say the word wasted. I'm glad he wasn't a Bond film as a villain, but I feel that, you know, he could have just made. I mean, he would just been an angry Scotsman. It would have been incredible. But it's a really tough one with him. I don't know, this the Hot Rock. It just makes me laugh now each time I see it, because that's all we really get to see, and I think it's an incredible concept that just maybe doesn't have the end product to match what I think what they set up with him.
Absolutely. I don't think they push that at all. You know, the whole concept that he's getting stronger and stronger and more invincible as it goes on. It does not. They do not use that. Yeah.
But
yeah.
I will say, I think he does commit to the role, right? I think he brings an intensity to it.
I have no problem with Robert Carlyle himself. Right. It's the problem is with the character and the script.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in regards to some new alloys, with so many returning ones, the only one I was able to source as a new ally is John Cleese in the role of R. Of course, would go on to play Q in Dying of a Day and Everything or Nothing if we want to include the games. But it came to be with his ex-wife, Alice Cleese, was friends with the producers, which was able to snag him a role in there. Now, I've been struggling to find interviews of him before being in James Bond. Everything post James Bond is John Cleese being John Cleese, if I'm being absolutely honest. so I've struggled to get anything pre The World Is Not Enough, which is a shame, because I think with a legend of British comedy, contextually in the late 90s, to replace Desmond Llewellyn when the time comes, I think it was a great idea. And it might also be a character that, due to an era ending, we never got to see that come to fruition properly too.
And you might be, this is 007.
If you're Q, does that make him R?
Ah, yes, the legendary 007 wit. Or at least half of it. Now, I dare say, 007, that you've met your match with this machine.
Yeah, new model, improved specs.
I thought you were on the inactive roster, some kind of injury.
Yes, well, we'll see about that. So,
as I was saying, the very latest in intercepts and countermeasures. Titanium armor, a multitasking heads-up display, and 6 beverage cup holders. All in all, rather stocked.
Right, on to production. So let's kick off with the pre-title sequence. So production begins on The World Is Not Enough on the 11th of January 1999 at Pinewood. We'll talk a bit more about Pinewood in a second. But the pre-title sequence at 14 minutes 20 seconds, it's the longest Bond pre-title sequence of the series up to date, until No Time to Die came along and blew that out of the water with 24 minutes. So mid-February, the main unit travelled to Bilbao in Spain to shoot the first half of the pre-title sequence near the Guggenheim Museum, where Bond escapes from the office. Brosnan does part of that stunt first, and then it's the stuntman Mark Mottram. They chose the Guggenheim because of it looking so spectacular, but the sort of the tale is that when they got there, they couldn't get it to shine on screen because the weather wasn't right, so they had to add that in afterwards. But I mean, one thing to note about the Bilbao shoot is that Brosnan and the shoot was absolutely besieged by fans who turned up to watch them doing it. They said, I think I read a report that was 100,000 people turned up to watch them shooting, which is absolutely unbelievable. It was basically like the height of Bond mania all over again, and Brosnan called it gobstoppingly wonderful. They all just gathered outside his hotel waiting to catch a glimpse of him as he came and went. So, amazing scenes, really. And then there were issues at the time with shooting in Turkey and Kazakhstan, so Spain had to double for several different places as well. So while they were there, they shot in a place in Bardenas Real, which is near Tudela, and that doubled for the Caucasus Mountains, which is the exterior entrance to the nuclear facility. So all that stuff outside the nuclear facility is actually in Spain. And there's a bit where you see Bond and Christmas Jones escaping from the mine and it explodes. It's a really good sequence, actually. And basically, the guy doubling for Bond, Mark Mottram, he had a fireproof suit on, but the lady doubling for Christmas Jones, Jo McLaren, didn't. She was basically wearing shorts and a T-shirt. So when they exploded, you see Mark actually has to jump between Jo and the explosion to protect her from the flames. It's quite an amazing detail when you watch it back. They also filmed at a place called Los Calajones, which doubled for the Turkish village, which had the church and the villagers that were protesting outside the pipeline. And there is a little bit of a myth, just bringing it back to the pre-title sequence, that the pre-title sequence is originally due to end when Bond jumped out the window in Bilbao, and that test audiences thought it needed more, and so they moved the credits to after the Thames sequence. But that's actually not true. If you dig into it, which MI6 did, they looked at the scripts and they found that the pre-title always ended with Bond's encounter with Cigar Girl on the Thames, although the original plan was for Bond to be flying in a jetpack rather than in a boat. So that was always the plan. And so this myth about the pre-title sequence being extended, I don't know where that comes from, but perhaps they might have toyed with it at one point in an early version of the film, but it definitely wasn't the plan originally. But the truth was that basically the boat sequence ended up getting made loads longer than it should have been, more complex because of Vic Armstrong basically going to town on it. So when they decided on the Thames, they committed to that full-heartedly. Yeah, basically they did that over a six-week shoot on the Thames. They worked closely with the London Film Commission, who took them on a tour of the Thames. And he ended his tour by showing them the foundations for what would be the Millennium Dome. And Michael Apted was just like, well, we've got to shoot on that. And that's how that came together. But there were lots and lots of obstacles they had to overcome to shoot on the Thames. The Thames has a speed limit of 8 to 10 knots, but the shoot required speeds of up to 40 knots. And MPs at the time, they complained and they were concerned about having jet boats on the Thames outside the Houses of Parliament. But Jack Straw, who was Foreign Secretary at the time, he told them all just to lump it because it was a huge advertising campaign for England and London. And so that basically secured them the rights to be able to do it. They had to build a model for the part where the hole is blown in the riverside wall. That was done in the model by John Richardson because they couldn't do that on the Thames itself. And the boats itself, Cigar Girl drives a 42-foot Sunseeker while Bond has this Q-boat. And there were 15 custom-built Q-boat shells that were made by a company called Riddle Marine of Idaho. They were shipped to the UK and then detailed by the guys at Pinewood. Four of the boats were functioning and operational, and they had these massive V8 engines. And incidentally, one of the boats, one of the Q boats, sold at the 60 Years of Bond auction for £126,000. So that's crazy. There is a point where the chase goes off the water at one point and then goes through the streets, and that was filmed at Wapping. And the boat stunts some of the boat stunts were filmed in Millwall Dock, under the Glengall Bridge, and the Isle of Dogs. And then a place called Chatham Dockyard was also used for part of the boat chase. One of my favourite pieces of trivia, though, is the parking wardens who get splashed. One of those was a guy called Ray Brown, who at the time was famous for being in a 1998 reality show called The Clampers. So that's a little cameo that's sort of lost to the details of time.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously the most dangerous part of the stunt sequence was the 360-degree barrel roll. And that was devised by Simon Crane and Gary Powell and looks absolutely sensational on screen. No slide whistle needed for that one. and then famously, Brosnan himself was on location to do a lot of the shooting there as well. And you can see him in detail, in close-up, doing a lot of the stunts. And he was the guy that came up with the idea of straightening the tie when he goes underwater as well. So lovely little detail there. But one of the most memorable pre-title sequences, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Yeah. And a great use of the dome. I thought that's inspired to see that and go, yeah, let's use that, because it made it feel more modern than it actually was, because it wasn't even open yet.
Yeah. And just a little fun fact I remembered about the dome, the bit where Bond is falling, tumbling down the roof of it, there's a bit where he gets trying to grab a hold of the cables and he falls past it. That was actually an accident on set. They were trying to get the stuntman to grab the cables, but he kept missing it, And what they did is just loop them together, so it made it look more dramatic, which I thought was a lovely bit of filmmaking.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah.
I feel like it's one of those scenes that, as time has gone by, as the O2, well, it became the O2, it's become such a massive venue now. Would you argue that's helped age this film in a really good way, that because it's still so current in the O2, when people come back to the world, it's not enough. It's very much, oh, we all recognise this building. And I think it's done wonders choosing it to be set there.
Absolutely, yeah.
Earlier on in the year, when they had, you know, we had those winds and a hole got ripped in the roof.
Yeah.
Yes.
Most of, you know, people thought about that moment, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think has any other film shot on top of it?
I don't think so.
Probably not.
It was almost a risk at the time because there was, I remember when it was being built that they thought it was going to be a temporary structure.
Yeah, 1 year.
Wasn't going to last. Yeah. So, yeah, it's worked out quite well.
Coffee? Medium sweet. 2 medium sweet.
Thanks for listening. We hope you're enjoying the James Bond A to Z podcast. Remember, if you want to support the show, we have a coffee page at ko-fi.com/JamesBondA to Z where you can buy us a coffee for just £3 or for £3 a month. Thanks for listening. Back to the show.
Is that all it does?
So off to Scotland, sort of, via Stowe School in Buckinghamshire, which acts as the site of the King estate, where the funeral is. That is playing the part of Loch Lomond, but it's a school, yeah, a school in Buckinghamshire, which is actually seen in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade as well.
Really?
There is a deleted scene as well that was shot there after his injury on the dome. He's driving to the funeral, but Miss Moneypenny is driving the Aston Martin. And Samantha Bond said, "I've got Mr. Brosnan sat next to me in this £250,000 car. He's sitting beside me saying, 'Faster, Bond, speed it up. It's not a girl's car at all. It's very, very heavy. There was no point to the scene. It was just fun.'" And that confused me when I read it because I was like, "Faster, Bond." But of course, Samantha Bond. But they did actually get to film in Scotland, much to Judi Dench's delight, because obviously she gets a much bigger role in this. So it meant she got out on location and got to shoot in Scotland and then later on in Turkey. So they went to the Eilean Donan Castle, which was used to portray MI6, their temporary operation base, Castle Thane, which is located, it's near the Isle of Skye, which is in West Scotland. And it's the same castle used in Highlander.
Wow.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And following there, we of course had the ski chase that was filmed in February 1999 at the French ski resort Chamonix. Apologies for any French pronunciations butchered there. This was led by Vic Armstrong of the 2nd Unit, and it was scheduled in for 4 weeks. However, there was a tragic accident on the 9th of February where an avalanche hit the ski resort, which unfortunately resulted in 12 people dying, alongside 14 buildings being destroyed and 20 cabins. The health and safety helicopters, of course, used for filming, and the crew was then diverted to, of course, help out with the ski resort to try and save who they could. I wasn't able to find the dates filming resumed, so it was of course delayed shooting there. And to my surprise, I don't know if this is insensitive or not, to then have an avalanche in the film is a very awkward thing that I thought about when doing this research. But there's any sort of light bearing, the mayor of Chamonix was sentenced to 3 months in prison for second degree murder due to the resort not having any adequacies or preparations for any potential avalanches, which, you know, is horrible when you read into it. And yeah, so not the easiest of shoots and history that comes from that. But of course, filming did eventually finish there. And the Parahawks themselves, one of my favourite actual Bond designs, they used paratroopers. United States paratroopers were then trained into the vehicles. At the start, they were too heavy for them to use, but they were trained on them in America, and then they eventually brought them all over into France to do the filming on location, which I thought was a great little touch. And of course, further on, Imagine Secret Service comparisons were made with how they fell off the side of the building. They believed it's done in sync with how the skiers were, and there was a reference to one of the, I believe, stunt designers who almost passed away on Her Majesty's filming, and they replicate that the Power Hawks, which I don't know how. I don't know if that's meant to be a sign of respect that, oh, you almost died, let's just reenact this with a villain's vehicle, but that's an Easter egg for someone who really wants that to be done as an Easter egg. So, yes, that was filming in France.
So a bit of a random one here, but there is a UK location in the movie which is sort of almost a blink and you'll miss it, a very unlikely location. And it was the Motorola building in Swindon, which was used to double for the external of the oil refinery. And this was found by Peter Lamont when he was away, in his own words, for a bridge weekend, which I think is card playing. So this building is quite unique. It was opened by a Queen in 1998 and it was designed as a major manufacturing facility. But when you look at it, pictures of it, it's like a big silvery building and it's got this huge like tubular pipe that runs across the top of it. I don't know why it was designed like that, but it was aluminium and glass. It was massive. It had housed 1,300 staff and had 28,000 square metres of manufacturing space and 4,500 square metres of offices. It was massive. And they had this huge, like I said, this pipe that runs across the top of the building, which was 5.5 metre diameter, big enough to drive a car through. And they spotted it. They thought it would work well to double for this building, and they got permission to do it. So Pierce Brosnan filmed on location there with Sophie Marceau in 1999. According to a local newspaper report at the time, Pierce Brosnan stayed at the Chiselden House Hotel and was seen enjoying a pint of Arkell's 3B at the nearby Plough Inn. So, fun little fun fact for you there. But unfortunately, Motorola moved out of the building in 2010 and it was dismantled. And there was some of the pipeline, exterior pipeline, is actually a real location in Wales as well, which I imagine a splinter unit went off and shot there. So, yeah, that's the pipeline.
And then in Turkey, the Maiden's Tower, which is a lighthouse built in the 11th century. It's at the mouth of the Bosphorus in Istanbul. That was used for Renard's hideout in Turkey. And you can actually see it in the background of From Russia With Love as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was actually restored in 1998 specifically for this, so they could shoot there. And then it was a year later, it was restored again as a precaution to an earthquake that happened in 1999. Now it can be visited. It's a cafe, it's a restaurant, and you can get a boat trip there, you know, to go and visit the tower. We had exteriors for Elektra's Baku Villa. They were shot at a pavilion in Istanbul, but the interiors were actually shot at in Luton in Bedfordshire.
A Luton Who, wasn't it?
Luton Who, yeah.
Yeah.
And alongside Luton, they did return back to Pinewood, which we know James Bond's history with the filming studios, and it was the first James Bond film to be filmed there since The Living Daylights in 1987, which, for those unfamiliar, of course, you detailed it in the License to Kill and Goldeneye and Tomorrow Never Dies episodes, with most of License to Kill being filmed in on location in Mexico. Goldeneye, of course, it is what is now Warner Brothers Leavesden, and Tomorrow Never Dies as well. So, most of it was for the studio work. However, I was able to get some details on some of the larger sets. So they used the 007 stage to shoot the nuclear facility. Of course, the finale takes place, which is, I think, a pretty underrated set. I know we don't get much time of it as it's submerging, but it's very Spy Who Loved Me, I've always felt. I don't know if it's because we get them, you know, in the Navy officer uniform as well. But alongside this, one of my favourite sets, a very weird one from this, is the Caviar Factory from Zakovsky. And this was filmed at the outdoor water tank at Pyramid. For those wondering why was there an outdoor water tank, well, of course, they build the factory on top of it, which makes for some great practical action set pieces. And, I mean, I'm not going to lie, I've never had caviar, so I don't know if it's liquidized or how it's made. So that's one of my questions. I always thought it was oil for many years. But knowing that was shot at the outdoor water tank at Pyramid, it's pretty cool. But yeah, it was the first Bond film back, which, you know, you think 12 years is a long time. But for the series that's famous for filming there, that, you know, three films away is massive, I thought.
Well, crucially, I mean, it's the first time Brosnan's got to film there, isn't it? So imagine it must have been a big moment for him to start shooting Bond at Pinewood. Mm-hmm. And this is when Brosnan meets Connery at Pinewood. So I think we covered this story on our Brosnan episode, Brendan, if you remember.
Yeah.
But he said, I think he was loading, putting his bags in the boot of his car, and he heard a distinctive voice, and it was Connery. And I think he sort of said something about make sure they're paying you well enough or something like that. Connery, always bringing it back to the wages.
Of course.
But I think there are some stunning sets in this. I think, like you mentioned, the submarine, I think, is great. And that was one of those sets that they put on like a movable gimbal type thing to rotate it and fill it up with water and stuff. And it is stunning work.
Is it because there's an underwhelming fight in the submarine? That's my issue, that you've got this incredible set, as if the angled set, and it's so not to harp on Renard again, because it's nothing to do with Robert Carlyle, but even the way in which he's dispatched with, you know, the reverse shooting through, I feel there's just that slightly wasted potential, because of course with Peter Lamont returning doing post Titanic, what's he get up to after that, you know, then let's destroy a submarine for James Bond as well. So it's great to see him back and that stage being utilised.
Right, let's look at post-production. So The World Is Not Enough obviously takes its title from the Ian Fleming book on Her Majesty's Secret Service, where Orbis Non Sufficit is revealed to be Bond's family motto by the Royal College of Arms. And the Orbis Non Sufficit is the actual motto of the real-life Sir Thomas Bond, who was a landowner who was made a baronet by King Charles II in 1658, and it's this Sir Thomas Bond that Bond Street itself is named after. Mm. And Ian Fleming made James Bond his sort of fictional ancestor in the books. But the phrase itself, Orbis Non Sufficit, is thought to originate from something called the Pharsalia by Lucan, where it appears twice. And the first is in reference to a group of villainous mutineers, and the second is in reference to Julius Caesar. But the use that we think of it as, this Orbis Non Sufficit, comes as a reference to Alexander the Great, where the full quote is, "A tomb now suffices for him for whom the world was not enough." So there you have it. And this motto as well was also previously used by Philip II of Spain.
I could have given you the world. Huh.
The world is not enough.
Foolish sentiment.
Family motto.
But other titles that were considered for the film were, they looked at Fleming chapter titles, one of them being A Whisper of Love, A Whisper of Hate. What do you think of that one?
No. The song would be bad as well.
No, bad, bad. Yeah, would be good for marketing tie-in for Whisper chocolate bars. But another one they looked at was Death Waits for No Man.
It's too long.
Which you can sort of see, them using sometime down the line. Fire and Ice, which sounds a bit like a Roger Moore film,
or a nightclub.
Game of Thrones. Had a Song of Fire and Ice started at that point as well? By the way,
I feel
the books had started then. It's still not finished though. So
probably. Another one they looked at was Pressure Point, which sounds like a Bond continuation novel, if you ask me.
Yeah.
And then Dangerously Yours, which I quite like.
That's the best one. Yeah. Huh? That's the best one of these ones.
And then another rumour was it was going to be called Bond 2000, because everyone was obsessed with Bond 2000 at the time. But
awful.
I can't imagine that would have ever been.
That would have dated that so badly.
Yeah.
Could you imagine if they'd made a genuinely contextual James Bond Y2K film to come out in 1999? How awfully it could have aged, you know. Yeah. At least in No Time's Light, it's not their fault. You know, they shot the film about, you know, deadly virus before that did come real. But the Y2K stuff scares me a bit, knowing that they could have, you know, had a bad day and done that.
Yeah, yeah.
But we got The World Is Not Enough, and I think it's a classic title.
Yeah, yeah. We see it on screen in on Majesty's Secret Service, don't we?
Yeah.
Yes, and there's been a bit of a, not behind the scenes, but the 007 store, renowned for its affordable pricing, they released some merchandise under the, I don't know if anyone's seen it on the news today at the time recording, but they've done a James Bond coat of armour logo. Of course, The World Is Not Enough being the family coat of arms. Turns out they were using the Blofeld one, not the James Bond one.
What? And,
they've had to recorrect their own merchandise now to say Blofeld's family motto, which is quite embarrassing.
Oh dear.
Brilliant. So on to the music, and we have David Arnold's second score. So the music he'd made for Tomorrow Never Dies was, you know, highly regarded. And so they asked him to come back. And he said there is an element of repetition because it's the same person writing about the same character. You need to find a different way of orchestrating it. So he said that he actually took much of his inspiration from Electra King. And he said that gives the score a bittersweet sound. And he uses the manipulation of the character, her vulnerability, her innocence, revenge, seduction. They're themes that David Arnold really used throughout his score to make it completely different to Tomorrow Never Dies. He said to write something beautiful and honest was very interesting to me, especially for a Bond movie. And he also had the task of composing the title song.
Yes, so The World Is Not Enough, sung by Garbage, written by David Arnold, and in his fifth Bond theme, we have Don Black returning as well. For those unfamiliar with his other ones, we have Thunderball, Diamonds Are Forever, The Man of the Golden Gun, and Surrender from Tomorrow Never Dies, which should have been the main theme for that. This was quite a fascinating one to read into. So this is a story of two halves. So we have Garbage, who at the time were on a world tour. It was their second world tour. And they were trying to get a recording date in for this and couldn't. So they were recording it throughout their tour at different destinations. And then they eventually went to Armory Studios in Canada in August of 99 to complete and edit the final version, which feels very close to a deadline, given that the writing for this song began, you know, with the pre-production of the film, that David Arnold wanted to write this as early as possible. Barbara Broccoli wanted this song to be done as early as they could. And of course, it would then release later that year. But in a wild turn of events, I'm not sure if anyone's familiar with this. Eon, MGM, Universal Music, and Universal Studios were sued by two songwriters, Frank P. Fogerty and Nathan Crowe, for copyright infringement for The World Is Not Enough theme. They claimed that the four-note sequence used was identical to a song they submitted to MGM called The Game We Play, a song that was not used for the second time we bring up this film tonight, The Thomas Crown Affair, which I thought was very interesting. This would go on for 5 years, and this was resolved in 2004 when a US court rejected the claim after going through evidence from all parties, including David Arnold, Barbara Broccoli, the Don Black, everybody involved, garbage. They went through their files, they went through their diaries, their notes, their history, to conclude that it was not stolen. It was more of a coincidence, and they conceded. And some of the behind the scenes of these two guys trying to take this to court, they were pretending to be employees of James Horner, who then used that to get through to Don Black and were recording conversations with him talking about writing the song. And they tried to get through to Shirley Mason, who was, of course, the lead singer from The World Is Not Enough, but didn't get through to her. One of the more wild stories from the behind the scenes, but the song itself, one of my favourites. It was sung earlier this year, of course, at the Sound of Bond concert, which you can stream not enough of it, but half of it on Amazon Prime. And it debuted at number 11 in the United Kingdom on our charts, which, you know, it's not surprising. But what are your thoughts on that song?
I'm a big fan. I like it.
For me, I think it's up there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I should have said it at the start, I'm sorry. But of course, it was written from the perspective of Electra King, who, you know, at the time in a pre-spoiler zone, it's the writings on, well, not a pun to that song, but the writings on the wall in the sense of, you know, we can see that, we can read that this is the, you know, the villain's thing. And kind of a more of a statement than I guess a question is that had this have come out in sort of 2021, for like No Time to Die, I think the over-analytical marketing for films, people would have probably worked that out in that respect to this film. But I love the fact it's one of those great things that you can look back on how many years after and think, oh, the theme's the point of view from the villain. And the villain isn't Renard, of course, female voice as well with Shirley Mason. So I absolutely love this theme, and it's one that's grown on me so much over the years. And I had a bit of beef with Spotify because they'd removed it for like 11 months and then he brought it back just before the concert in October. So my playlist was incomplete for a year.
Yeah, I think it's easy to forget as well. I mean, when you look at it in the canon, Garbage seems a bit of an unusual choice, but they were absolutely massive at the time. Yeah. They were just a huge, huge act. And I think they really knocked it out of the park. I think it's one of the best of the modern era theme songs. It's timeless, I think. And I think that it helps, you know, that David Arnold, Don Black, they were all able to work on it where, you know, they'd had issues with the Tomorrow Never Dies and studio interference. With this, they got what they wanted and delivered, I think, a classic theme.
We've said all along when we got together in Garbage, you know, if we had a dream, it would be to record the Bond theme, just because of the sensibility is quite similar to how we approach making music.
But and it also helps that the titles, I think, personally, Daniel Kleiman's titles for this are some of the best he's ever done. He worked, so he's back having done GoldenEye and then Tomorrow Never Dies. And so this is his third one in a row. And he worked with the digital effects studio Smoke and Mirrors for this. And his motif for this one, which I think is one of the strongest, is that oil motif that runs through it. And he worked very closely with David Arnold to make sure that he was in sync with what he was planning for the title song. And David Arnold said he sent him the demo for the theme song literally the day after he submitted it to Michael and Barbara so that Daniel Kleiman could start work on it. Talking about it, Daniel Kleiman said, "Very thin coats of oil and petrol on puddles give you an amazing refraction of colour. In the studio, I photographed petrol on the surface of water and then used that footage to wrap around images of worlds and planets. I felt sorry for these poor girls. We poured fake oil all over them as I wanted the oil to define the shapes of the models." And he said that it's probably one of the more effects-driven sequences. It maybe felt a bit overproduced, almost too digital. But I disagree. I think it's one of his best. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think it's another classic.
I'm not a big fan of the Tomorrow Never Dies one. I know a lot of people very much enjoy it with, you know, the whole microchips, but for them to take the oil into account, and the way I see it is, as we move into this, you know, not to do a Y2K pun, but as we move into the more digital era, it's amazing to see some of the what they were capable of doing in the 90s for these films. And I certainly think Tomorrow Never Dies and this is that real leap forward into, you know, obviously, I'd say the absolute high of Casino Royale in 2006, but I think the main thing is it matches the theme and the actual film itself.
It's time to release the film. So you mentioned he did a screening, a private screening. In August 1999, yeah, Michael Apted, he screened The World Is Not Enough. And he said, staggeringly, we previewed the film 5 weeks after we finished shooting. Poor old Jim Clark, eh? So, and Jim Clark himself, he said the reaction was quite underwhelming. He said, although there were no walkouts, we felt a distinct hostility. So that gave them, you know, until November to rectify any issues that people had, you know, raised. 8th November 1999, The World Is Not Enough gets its premiere in LA, and then in it gets a European charity premiere on the 22nd of November at the Odeon in Leicester Square. Now, reception at the time was mixed. And we have Roger Ebert, who we always reference on this. He said it was a splendid comic thriller, exciting and graceful, endlessly inventive. And he gave it 3.5 stars out of 4.
Mm.
Yeah. The Atlanta Journal disliked it, and they said it was dated and confused. The AV Club said that there's enough fun moments scattered throughout to make a decent Bond entry, but the series still needs a massive shot of fresh ideas. The Independent said the film is certainly less definitively feeble than other Bond offerings, with at least a two-dimensional female character in the bold and oval Marceau. But my reaction is much the same as the new Rolling Stones album. I'm just grateful that it's not embarrassing. Some of the main criticisms were of Denise Richards. And Variety said that she was the least plausible nuclear physicist in the history of movies. And she was actually ranked as one of the worst Bond girls of all time by Entertainment Weekly in 2008. But in contrast, Sophie Marceau, she was praised for her portrayal of Elektra. And The Guardian called her terrific, sexy, stylish, with a really beautiful face, entirely innocent of the cosmetic surgeon's art. So, you know, retrospectively, this was in 2012, so yeah, 13 years after, Variety said that it presents a conflicted persona torn between the corny antics of the Roger Moore era and the grim seriousness of where things would eventually go under Daniel Craig's tenure. It also contains a dose of Timothy Dalton-esque toughness. Much of what made Brosnan such a great Bond is thrust into the backseat by lame jokes and the premature attempt to mix up the formula. And Entertainment Weekly actually said in 2006 it's the worst Bond film of all time. Said it's so convoluted, even Pierce Brosnan has admitted to being mystified. And IGN in 2007 chose it as the fifth worst Bond. In terms of the box office, though, it was $361 million, and it actually made more than GoldenEye. Brosnan himself at the time was satisfied, and he said, "We came out the gate with GoldenEye, and now looking back, it seems like I was just a baby then. My assuredness with the role and my confidence has grown a lot, and quite frankly, I couldn't have expected anything less of myself. And I think the same could be said of Connery. If you look at him in Dr. No in 1962, and then his third time in Goldfinger, there was a whole mystique about the third Bond when the actor really gets into his stride." This, of course, was the end of his Bond contract. It was just a 3-film contract that he originally signed. But Michael G. Wilson said, if he's game for another, well, then we certainly are. It's certainly in all of our minds at the moment. And then in May 2000, I think we've talked about this, but MGM and Danjak took out a 2-page advertisement in Screen International, and they congratulated Pierce Brosnan, calling him our billion-dollar Bond. And that was a reference to the combined box office gross that they had taken for the 3 of his Bond films to this date. In terms of awards, so Brosnan actually won the Empire Award and Blockbuster Entertainment Award as Best Actor. David Arnold won a BMI Film Music Award for his score. And this one actually became the first in the series to win a Golden Raspberry. Any guesses for what category?
Christmas Denise Jones. Richards.
It is Christmas Jones as Worst Supporting Actress at the 99 Razzie Awards. They were also, Richards and Pierce Brosnan were also nominated for Worst Screen Couple. But they didn't win that one. They lost out to Will Smith and Kevin Kline in Wild Wild West. So they didn't get that one. So, yeah, there you go. Not many awards to be proud of, anyway.
Right. Let's have a look then. Let's open it up to what our followers on Twitter think of the movie before we have a good chat about the film itself. So our three-word reviews, we put these out on our Twitter account and you guys respond in your droves. And a lot of responses for this one. So let's go straight into them. Jackson Flickinger said inspiring but flawed. Jack McMorrow goes with Desmond bows out. Space Odds 1985, plot hold dreariness. Ooh, that's harsh. Jukebox Jim goes with fantastic pre-title. I think we can agree on that. Jesper Ling, weird pain face. Come on. Nikolai, a friend of the show, he says kinky torture chair. Brosnan's best performance, which is interesting. And fantastic femme fatale. Andy, he went for my favourite Bond. So this is Andy's favourite Bond. Elektra is amazing. Brosnan is best. Brendan, is that you? Luke, half monk, half hitman, says most Fleming Brosnan. And, oh, this is a bit of a tenuous one, but underappreciated character exploration. And also Skyfall Part 1, which is interesting, something we can talk about in a second. Neil Lee, training. Says Bond betters Begbie and awful festive pun. People are going for loads now. Chris kinda sorta believes, I don't know what that Twitter handle is in reference to, but he says top tier pre-title sequence, top tier brozza. Oh, and this echoes something that you said earlier, Brendan. Neil Lee also says waste of Carlisle. Deepak calls it top 10 Bond. And then finally, Robert Nance, better than Skyfall.
So wow. There you have it. That is a hot take.
Yeah. So a lot of Skyfall references there. What's that in reference to, do you think?
Getting character development, I feel.
Yeah, I think that's definitely where that comparison comes from. Obviously written by the same people, right? Yeah. Purvis and Wade. So I think you'll find, yeah, they sort of tend to have a habit of recycling a lot of their ideas. And so, yeah, I can see that sort of connection to Skyfall in a way. And also, you know, they're in a remote place in Scotland as well, the MI6 people. So you can sort of see that as well. But I mean, Brendan, let's start with you. I mean, you're the big Brosnan fan. Where does this stand? What do you think of this movie now? How does it rank for you?
In terms of Brosnan, it's his worst. And it's just so, was it somebody said, called it dreary. And that, I do tend to agree with that. There is a lot of dreariness in it. A lot of it looks washed out. It's not that exciting to watch, I don't think. Yeah, I just, and in terms of Bond, it doesn't feel like a Bond film a lot of the time. I think that might be my problem with it. It's great that they give Brosnan's Bond this time to sort of add to his character and give him more depth, but I just don't think it delivers. I don't think it's got the other ingredients, the Bond ingredients that we always talk of. I just don't think it's got enough of them to make it something that I would watch, you know, if I had the choice.
Yeah. What about you, George?
I'm kind of on the not an opposite path, but for me this is comfortably my second favourite of his four. I think performance-wise, the three-word review from earlier, Brosnan's best performance, I would agree with that. One thing I'll notice is that I got to see this early this year for the 60th anniversary screenings at the cinemas. I only went for the Brosnan ones, not to make a statement. I just there's a fair play to anyone that did any of them every week. That's incredible. But I was so excited to see this on the big screen, and the action scenes were incredible. But when it wasn't action, there was just something off. And after tonight, obviously, of course, with the cameras, how it was shot like a soap opera, that's kind of lingered with me a bit. So I definitely agree that there are a lot of flaws with this film. But I think what I love about it, which is, and it kind of pairs with Tomorrow Never Dies for me, is this. I think the story itself is decades ahead. That, you know, the happy coincidence of Barbara Broccoli seeing that Newsnight report, you know, of the oil stuff, without getting into the sort of sport things, but you know, oligarchs buying football clubs happens today. In the certainly mid-noughties, Roman Abramovich is probably the most famous example of that. And seeing the power individuals can have with what oil gets you. I think as I've got older and gone back to this film, I see the plot and think, you know what? It's a very well, you know, it's not just a megalomaniac for the sake of being a megalomaniac. There's a goal with what Elektra King is working towards. And Robert King as well, I love the whole dynamic that in her theory, you know, her dad took her mother's empire, essentially. So there's a lot of things I like in there, but I definitely understand why it's one that's not as high up on other people's lists. You know, it's not one I would throw on, you know, if someone says, you know, pick a Bond film to watch tonight. Obviously, I'll go with GoldenEye. I'd probably, for Brosnan, then go with Dying of a Day, if I'm being honest, because I think there's unbelievable amounts of fun in there. And so, you know, from a social dynamic, watching people would be great, but The World Is Enough, it's not tricky for me because I'm also massively biased because it's the first Bond film I got to watch, so I will defend it for the sake of that. I had a great PS1 game that came with it. But, yeah, it's a really interesting one for me that I feel over the course of the last year or two that I have seen a lot more people speaking up and not... I hate the term defending the film, but I think certainly Bond as a fan base is more open to discussions on what works for some and doesn't for others and having dignified conversations and like some other fandoms. And it's really interesting hearing everyone else's thoughts on The World Is Not Enough because, you know, some of those polls that we listed, you know, mid to late noughties, putting it right at the bottom. To me, it's absolutely not near that bottom of the pile. I think there's a lot worse. But it is really interesting seeing how different people will have those sort of different reactions to it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I've got to agree with you, Brendan. I think it's probably his worst. I mean, for me, I really struggle with the middle two Brosnan films. Tomorrow Never Dies and The World Is Not Enough. I really, really love Brosnan as Bond. I can't stress that enough. I love Brosnan as Bond. But the two films in the middle, I just find them a bit of a slog to get through. And this one, there are, like you say, there are a lot of things to appreciate in it, a lot of things to like in it. I know it has people out there who absolutely love this and class it as one of the best Bond films. I just can't get on board with that, I'm afraid. Some of the things I will say that are in terms of like the female roles in the film, yes, I think they've done a good step in the right direction in this film compared to what we have had in the past. Specifically, Elektra King, they've given her a complex role. They've cast an actor who is actually interesting and isn't just there as eye candy. I think she does a good job in the role. And then M obviously gets a much more beefed up role. But then on the flip side, you've got Christmas Jones, who's just one of the most nonsensical characters ever committed to film.
Yeah.
And that's no disrespect to Denise Richards. I actually think she puts in a good effort for what she's given. But it's all costume for her. And really, she doesn't get much else to be done. And then I think other things I like about it, I like the music in the film. I think the music's really well done by David Arnold. Like I said, I like the titles. I think some of the stunts are pretty good as well. The snow stuff looks really nice on camera. But there's just such a disparity between the stunt stuff and then the drama stuff. And when it comes to the drama, it's almost melodrama in this. And I think that sort of hints at where Barbara and Michael were hoping the franchise could go. Obviously, we got a step backwards with Dying of the Day. But I think it's sort of you see the seeds of what becomes the Daniel Craig era in this movie, in that everything's overwrought. And unfortunately, I just think Michael Apted wasn't the right guy to turn it round. I think you count it, there's like three or four occasions where someone just gets slapped around the face out of anger. And that in itself is a soap opera trope, isn't it? It doesn't belong in Bond.
No.
And so for that, for all those different reasons, I find it hard to, like you say, it's never top of the pile to watch for me. But when you look at all the creatives involved, as we always do with the Bond films, there's so much good stuff in there. You can't dismiss it completely. There is worse Bond films out there for me, but this is not near the top of the pile at all. Sadly. No.
And the other frustrating thing is like that quote that Brosnan says, you know, by the third Bond film, look at Connery, Goldfinger, look at Moore, The Spy Who Loved Me, and look at Daniel Craig, Skyfall, and we get this as Pierce Brosnan's third film. It's just, it's so frustrating what could have been, because he's right. At this point, he is confident. He's assured. He's playing a Bond. He knows he can play Bond and he knows he can play it well. And he just doesn't get the script that he deserves.
Do you both think the 2 year gaps, you know, it's a very controversial take these days, but do you think the 2 year gaps actually damaged Bond, that this idea came straight after Tomorrow Never Dies? She's on a flight after promoting it. And it's, you know, oh, we've got a pre-production, you know, really going on the next one already. And there are instances like this, right? I love the concept of the oil stuff, but the 2 year gaps, I think, as you evolve into modern filmmaking, and certainly the late 90s heading into noughties, you know, digital era really spikes that up. It's a lot harder, and films, I think, should be project by project. Having that bit of patience in the middle, not too long, you know, like some of the ridiculous gaps we've had. But I definitely feel that the bookend shelf of the Brosnan is that those middle two films, I think he even joked about himself, he never knows which way around World Is Not Enough and Tomorrow Never Dies are. And I think because you start with GoldenEye, you end with Dying of a Day, they're the two talking points for everyone about Brosnan's Bond, and they get lost in the middle, I feel, especially the general audience.
Yeah, I definitely think that it is an issue. They had a huge success in 1995 with GoldenEye. And on that, obviously, you know, they'd panicked whether it would ever be a thing again. So, of course, they're going to green light Tomorrow Never Dies straight away. But had they have given it time to breathe and used GoldenEye as that platform, a bit more patience, who knows where it would have gone. You know, we could have had an amazing Bond film.
Yeah, I think the issue here as well is there's sort of a... But they hadn't had, or they had had in the earlier Bond films, is that they didn't have the continuity of the writer who knew exactly what was going on. You know, Richard Maybaum had written pretty much all of those first Bond films. But now they're in a position where they're sort of flitting between Bruce Feirstein, Michael France, who the other guy was on GoldenEye. And then on this one, they've got... you know, on Tomorrow Never Dies, they dealt with loads of different writers to try and tackle that story. I just think they were having a sort of a crisis of identity. And that was obviously clear with GoldenEye. They didn't know what Bond could be, what they wanted Bond to be. They managed to strike it lucky there. And then they were just basically stumbling through the rest of the Brosnan's era, which is a real shame, really. What they needed is a good writing team that would do the whole era for them. I think Bruce Feirstein might have been the guy for them, but unfortunately they were shopping around a lot, and it just never came together for them. Mm. Brendan, if you had to say something nice about the film, what do you like about it?
I still love the pre-title sequence. I know it's ridiculous and I know it's long, but that boat chase, you know, it's an incredible piece of filmmaking as well.
And George, I mean, obviously you've been very positive about it anyway, but I was just wanted to ask you quickly before you go, just about the video game.
Yeah,
what was that like? I never played that one.
All I can ever remember is the terrible voice actor that's not Pierce Brosnan, and the opening scene he screams Renard, really. It's not Pierce Brosnan, sorry, it's whoever's meant to be the banker. But the actual video game, I remember it being amazing. You had to play poker, which, you know, I was like five. I didn't know how to play poker, so Dad would do those levels with me. I remember it being a great game. I actually played it last year. I got the PS1 out when we were going through the films one by one. Played it, and it's still not bad, you know? And I think this is where, you know, the Brosnan era is beautiful for video games, in the sense that, you know, we had... you know, Bond films that were games, that were original, you know, in the early noughties, and some of the adaptations I thought were great. And this film in particular is so well suited to video games. You get this, here's an opening at a bank of an explosion, here's a pre-title sequence, here's a chase, here's the snow levels. It really lended itself to an actual video game. Now, it's no GoldenEye, don't get me wrong, but I have some very fond memories of this, and it is an interesting one.
Very good. George, what can you tell us about Cinema Savvy? What are you guys up to at the moment?
So we've just finished our two big series. We ran a Steven Spielberg retrospective that covered pretty much all of 2022. And many thanks to people joining us on there. Tom, yourself, of course, submitted a top 10. So if you're a fan of Steven Spielberg, you can check out that series, which is on demand. We're just planning at the moment for 2023. It's a pretty big year. There's some big films coming out. There's some franchises, there's some directors we want to have a look at. It's a bit quiet. We've had our busy period, but For any Bond fans that are curious, we did a lot of stuff to mark the 60th anniversary earlier this year, including an insane ranking video on what we believe the 60 greatest James Bond moments are. So if you want to check out some Bond stuff, you can definitely find that on our YouTube channel. But if you want some film reviews, news, discussions, then give us a follow, hit the subscribe button, and there might be some interesting stuff coming up. There is a spy franchise coming out next year, not James Bond, unfortunately, but we will, of course, be covering that alongside a few other things.
Do you mean Mission Impossible?
100%, yeah, I can't wait.
Listen, you can say Mission Impossible on it. It's not a curse word on the bottom pop there.
It's fine. Any chance I can get to talk about Tom Cruise, Tom, you know me, but now I will. And a few more of his films I won't go amiss. And I can't wait for the Bond comparisons every week when that starts in June. But, there will be a James Cameron retrospective starting in January of next year. We'll go through all of his films leading up to Titanic as that gets its beautiful 4K remaster, having Avatar 2 coming out this December. So James Cameron on the warpath, Denis Villeneuve the end of next year, and a few other things in between.
Very nice. Right, Brendan, we will be back next week talking about Thunderball. But in the meantime, if people want to get hold of us, how do they find us on social media?
At James Bond A to Z on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram.
If people want to email the show, you can get us at podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk. So on that note, just want to say thank you, George, from Cinema Savvy. And just to say that the James Bond A to Z podcast will return next week.
Ciao.
Bye.
The James Bond A to Z podcast is hosted and produced by Tom Butler and Brendan Duffy, with music by Tom Ingemels and artwork by Helene Dolly. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please like and subscribe and leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
You're not retiring anytime soon, are you?
Now pay attention, 007. I've always tried to teach you two things. First, never let them see you bleed.
And the second?
Always have an escape plan.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.